Hello, I'm Micah. This is Book It. The following views presented in this half hour do not reflect the views of KDVS. KDVS sponsors the University of California. I'm back, you know, on this show, like I say every other week, we review and talk about a new book. Yeah, this is a crazy episode today because I think this is the last show of the quarter for me, because the next two shows are, one's in December, like mid-December, but I believe I'll be in Texas, so I can't be here for that. And the other one will, I think, is early January, which I might be able to do, but unknown at the time. So for now, this is the last show of Book It for the quarter. But yeah, like I said, every other week or every week, depending on the quarter, we review a different book. And we have kind of different... Actually, the first two quarters of Book It, me and my co-host had no theme at all, really. It was just books that we wanted to read. So, like, our first quarter, me, DJ Drainfield, Radio Raheem, we all just compiled, like, a list of, like, five books each. And we kind of just debated for, like, 3 hours about who was, like, what books we were going to read. It became, like, a whole crazy thing. We ended up reading books that we all wanted to read because Radio Raheem decided to be weird about his voting for things. I don't know. And then the second quarter was a lot easier because there's only two of us. So I just chose five books and DJ Drainfield chose five books because we were weekly during the summer. But this quarter, both my co-hosts have graduated. So now it's just me. So I get to choose every single book, which truthfully makes this a lot harder. Like when I was starting Book It this quarter, I chose... a bunch of books because what we do is we pre-choose the books, so every book is decided like weeks in advance, but this quarter I changed it up almost like halfway through, and so the last like four books like from the past couple weeks are completely different than what they were originally going to be, and honestly that's just because what I wanted to read changed, so next quarter it might be kind of similar, I don't know, but yeah, so this quarter we focused mainly on women authors and you know, their works. We read a lot of books about feminism and stuff like that. Next quarter, don't know if there's going to be a theme or not. I haven't decided. We'll see what happens. I'm thinking maybe just, like, more female authors. Or maybe I might focus on a country or maybe two countries or an area, a geographical area in the world. We'll see, so stay tuned for that if you'd like. Not sure when Book It will be. That will be announced whenever. Hopefully we're still in the Wednesday slot, but we'll see what happens. But yeah, anyways, let's talk about the book. The book this week was The Will to Change: Men, Masculinity, and Love by Bell Hooks. Shout out to Bell Hooks. Last week we reviewed The Vegetarian by Hong Kay. So we kind of just change what we're reading every week, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Just depends on how I'm feeling in the moment. But yeah, so The Will to Change, Man, Masculinity, and Love by Bell Hooks. If you don't know who Bell Hooks was, because she passed away, she was a scholar and activist, and a lot of her work examined the connections between race, gender, and class. And she often explored the varied perceptions of Black women and Black women writers and the development of feminist ideas. When she was around 18, she began writing Ain't I a Woman, Black Woman and Feminism, which became her first full-length book. It was published in 1988, I believe. She's also from the South, or, well, is Kentucky the South? I don't really think so. It's kind of like the Middle West. I don't know. That's all for interpretation. I'm from Texas, and I think that's very Southern, but some people say it's not, which I don't agree with. So I don't know, that's up for debate. But yeah, she then studied literature at Stanford for her bachelor's. She got her master's, I forgot where, and then she got her PhD at University of California, Santa Cruz, so shout out for that. A lot of goats at Santa Cruz. Angela Davis famously taught at Santa Cruz. But yeah, her real name is Gloria Jean Watkins, and the name Bell Hooks was her great-grandmother's name. And so she used that as her pen name instead of her real name to honor her female legacies and lineage. And she often spells it in all lowercase. So you'll often see Bell Hooks written in all lowercase, like on books and just like in articles and things like that. And it's on purpose. Because the reason for that is, like, she wanted her works to be more important than her name. So having it lowercase kind of, like, made her name kind of less important than the name of the book or, like, article or thing she was writing, if that makes any sense. But yeah, her work imagined radical ways of being in the world, and encouraged love of self, oh my gosh, and community, while calling for liberatory practices that reshape feminism as an embodied challenge to intersecting structures of oppression. Did I say I don't know. Sometimes I'll just say words on here. If you hear that, ignore it if you'd like. Sometimes I'll talk way too fast, like way faster than I'm thinking. And so words just come out really wrong sometimes. And you'll hear me correct myself multiple times, but my apologies. I feel like I have to start making that disclaimer. But yeah, so that's a little bit about Bell Hooks. I'm also going to do something a little bit different during the show today. I'm going to go over the book and talk about the book and, you know, give my review, of course. Also, spoiler warning. I should probably give that in the beginning of the show. I'm essentially going to go over every single thing that she talks about in the book. Well, not every single thing, but the big ideas of each chapters. So if you're not into that, I would recommend not listening if you'd like. But I'm also going to play, I think in the middle of the show, to give myself a break from talking, a short little interview clip of her just speaking about some of the topics that are touched on in this book. So stay tuned for that if you'd like. But yeah, The Will to Change. It's a super short book. Okay, I was discussing this with DJ Lazzy yesterday. I feel like the more you read, the more, like, the longer, like, how do I explain this? The more you read, the shorter books become, if that makes sense. I feel like, for me, short books are around, like, 300 or less pages, but that's just because I read, like, really often, and I'm usually reading, like, longer books sometimes. So this book, to me, I realized, because I was talking about a book that I was reading, or The Vegetarian, actually. I was talking about The Vegetarian with DJ Lazzy yesterday, and I mentioned that the book was short, and it was only 200 pages, and they were like, oh, they called me out for it. But yeah, so to me, this book is short. It's only 188 pages. It's not super long. And her prose and, like, writing is very understandable. I feel like a problem with a lot of theory is that it can be written in a way that is, like, sort of hard to understand for, like, most people. And I think that kind of creates a big blockade of people wanting to read theory but not being able to kind of understand what is being said, or having, like, struggling, like, to read what's being said. But I think that Bell Hooks does a great job of getting her thoughts across in a great way without making it extremely hard to understand. And like I said, super short. The chapters aren't super long. There's about 12 chapters in this book. So yeah, shout out to her. I love when authors make it more accessible for the majority of people to read. But yeah, big fan of the book. Super short, 188 pages. The cover, I don't really like the cover of this copy of the book. Completely unrelated to the review. I'm just looking at it and I really just don't like it. This has become a big thing I've been thinking about, as book covers. And this is just one I don't like. But anyways, we'll move past, because that's not important. But The Will to Change, it's basically essentially a feminist philosophy book that seeks to articulate and subvert the patriarchal constraints that make it difficult for people to give and receive love. She states, or Bell Hooks writes, masses of men have not even begun to look at the ways that the patriarchy keeps them from knowing themselves, from being in touch with their feelings, from loving. She also states that to know love, men must let go of the will to dominate. They must be able to choose life over death. They must be willing to change. Yeah, so the book also essentially provides critiques of modern male dysfunction, as well as hopeful visions for the new kinds of masculinity that can escape and reconfigure outdated models of manhood. Also, I want to say, if it sounds like I'm, like, stumbling, it's because before each show, I essentially write down every single topic or every single thing that I want to touch on or talk about, and my handwriting is incredibly small and weird, and so it's even hard for me to read it sometimes. So if you're wondering, that's why. I have a whole, like, notebook where I just write every single thing. Because I find that with these, shows, I used to like kind of go over things and then completely forget to talk about other things I really wanted to talk about. And so the notebook kind of just keeps it all organized and keeps me on track as well. But yeah, that's essentially what the book is about. It's really, really interesting. So chapter one, which is titled, I forgot to write it down the chapter name. I'm so sorry. Yeah, so there's 12 chapters. Chapter one is titled Wanted, Men Who Love. Chapter two is Understanding Patriarchy. Chapter three is Being a Boy. Chapter four is Stopping Male Violence. Chapter five is Male Sexual Being. Chapter six is called Work, What's Love Got to Do with It. Chapter 7 is called Feminist Manhood. Chapter 8 is called Popular Culture, Media Masculinity. Chapter 9 is Healing Male Spirit. Chapter 10 is Reclaiming Male Integrity. And Chapter 11 is Loving Men. There's only 11 chapters. I thought there was 12. That's awkward. But yeah. So let's just get right into it, I guess. So chapter 1... Let me fix my mic a little bit. So chapter 1... essentially begins by diving into the pervasive concept of what the patriarchy is and how it significantly shapes the lives of men. The patriarchy is a social system where men hold the primary power, quote unquote, and it manifests through various social norms and expectations placed upon men from a young age. The system prescribes a limited and often harmful version of masculinity that men are pressured to conform to, which kind of results in broad repercussions, not only for women, but for men themselves. And this is often really overlooked and not really talked about. And so this is completely what... Also, I will say, a lot of the things I'm going to mention in chapters 1 and 2 are kind of repeated and talked about throughout the rest of the chapters. So my conclusions and like summaries for the rest of the chapters will also be a lot shorter than the first two chapters. Just a little warning there. So she argues that societal expectations of masculinity demand that men adhere to a rigid set of behaviors and attitudes. For example, suppressing emotions, displaying dominance, and prioritizing work and success over personal relationships. These expectations create a profound disconnect for men, forcing them to hide their vulnerabilities and genuine feeling in favor of projecting an image of control and strength. This in turn fosters internal emotional harm and a sense of isolation as men are discouraged from forming deep emotionally supportive connections with others. So the patriarchy essentially inflicts significant emotional damage on men, and men are essentially trained to suppress emotions, which leads to internalized pain and outward aggression, which we'll talk about a lot more, male violence and the normalization of male violence. This also results in a disconnection from their true selves and an inability to engage authentically with those around them, thereby perpetuating a cycle of emotional poverty and violence. And we'll see this throughout like the rest of the chapters, is she references and mentions this perpetual cycle that's imposed by the patriarchy on men from a young age. And she also says that men's liberation from traditional gender roles and societal structures is essential for creating a more equitable and loving society for all. And chapter two, I'm just gonna get straight into it because I realized I talked way too much in the beginning, so we gotta move along because I want to be able to play this clip at the end. Chapter two is titled Understanding Patriarchy. Throughout this chapter, she essentially talks about the societal mandate for men is to be upholding pillars of strength, which fosters an environment where emotional intelligence is not nurtured. And this is kind of something she also talks about and references in chapter one, but she kind of goes more into detail in chapter two. Men learn to view emotional openness as vulnerability, a trait which is deemed weak by conventional masculinity, and conforming to patriarchal standards leads to emotional numbness and aggression as a misguided form of expressing inner turmoil. Internalization of feelings dampens their ability to build and sustain healthy relationships. And she also talks about and discusses how vulnerability is an essential component of true love and connection. Same with emotional honesty. So this goes into her point that love in its truest form demands openness and the courage to reveal one's innermost self to another. And the patriarchy essentially dictates emotional suppression, which directly conflicts with these requirements. and it places men in a paradoxical position where their quest for genuine love is ruined by the very norms that they are compelled to follow and they perpetuate themselves. And she kind of also discusses briefly, and kind of throughout the book as well, that women, they can help and support men, but essentially the responsibility to overcome these like patriarchal norms about masculinity is the responsibility of men themselves. And so women should not feel burdened with having to change it themselves. Chapter 3 is titled Being a Boy. And in this chapter, she essentially goes into the emotional lives of young boys, and she talks about how their emotions are devalued from birth. She also talks about how the widespread patriarchal thinking forces some to neglect the emotional development of their sons. She also starts to talk more about popular media and how popular media kind of perpetrates this idea as well. And it leads to the insufficient models for emotional expression, which also leads boys to mask their grief with anger, leading to self-isolation. And this popular media, which she also talks about in a later chapter, more in depth, essentially reinforces a culture where anger is the norm. And this all goes back to the cycle of abuse and emotional neglect. In chapter 4, I'm moving quickly because we only have 12 minutes left. The show, the 30 minutes sometimes is just not enough for this show. Chapter 4 is titled Stopping Male Violence. And throughout this chapter, she talks about how violence by men in America is often dismissed as natural and even often perpetrated by the patriarchal belief linking male biology to violence. This also kind of goes into the idea of emotional abuse and how emotional abuse has become systematic in a lot of families and is deemed as normal. And not really talked about, and kind of women and children are often forced to kind of silence themselves from even talking about it. And again, this connects back to the cycle of abuse that she talks about in chapters 1 and 2 and 3. And this is a big theme throughout the entire book, is this cycle. She also talks about, very importantly, how mothers also perpetuate cycles of violence against their sons, which inadvertently supporting oppressive structures. And she kind of goes into depth, even with her own personal experiences, about how like her own mother kind of forced patriarchal standards on her and her sister growing up. Another part of the book, which I didn't really write down, but I want to mention, is how she talks about how these women will kind of abide by the patriarchal norms or whatever, and in turn kind of hurt themselves. And she talks about how, like, for example, her mother married her father, and because she subscribes to these patriarchal beliefs and stuff, even though she's completely unhappy living with her father and being married to him, she won't divorce him, and says that she'll stay with him and stick by him because of the norms that were imposed on her as a child. Like I said, this all goes back to the cycle that she talks about throughout this entire book. She mentions a lot of her own personal experiences throughout this entire book. I probably won't bring up a lot of them just because there's just too much information. Like I said, we don't have a lot of time in this show. So she says, what else did I write down here? She says, so this violence that is like kind of deemed as normal for men and boys kind of ends up having long-term consequences for them and their relationships with women in general. She also talks about how the media glorifies male violence, and that violence equals manhood. And this goes back to this whole what masculinity is, and what the patriarchy perpetuates, the idea of what masculinity is. And finally, she, of course, goes back to all of this and says kind of discusses how violence is normalized and or rewarded in our society. Chapter 5 is called Male Sexual Being. She goes into a lot of detail about certain things, but some of the things she talks about I cannot say on the air, unfortunately. So I'll just go over this chapter extremely briefly. She talks about how sexual norms and patriarchal beliefs lead to issues such as rape and child abuse, which leads to how victims are often blamed instead of addressing the broader systemic issues. She also talks about how the media depicts outdated gender roles and promotes male domination over women. And she ties this all in by essentially describing how it contributes to a culture where male sexual violence is completely normalized. And she talks about a lot more things in depth in this chapter, but like I said, I can't really talk about some of that on the air, so we'll have to go over this really briefly. Chapter 6, she essentially talks about how the patriarchy historically has tied men's self-esteem to work, and how with women being able to work now, it kind of like affects them in like a negative way. This is a whole nother chapter. I'm going to speed it up a little bit because we only have a very, very short time. Chapter 7. Actually, after this, I might slow down a little bit. Chapter 7 is titled Feminist Manhood. And she talks about how we perceive, or feminism is essentially perceived as a threat to men and just in general. And despite the understanding that feminism promotes gender equality, there still exists a widespread belief that feminist movements and ideas have detrimental effects on men and what is considered the family. And this is just not true, of course. She also talks about how the patriarchy fosters misogyny and a fear of femininity in men. And so she concludes this by also saying genuine movement towards feminist masculinity must include models that redefine maleness in a positive light. So this is kind of like the essential theme of the entire book, is that we kind of have to use feminism and work towards a way where we can redefine what masculinity truly is, because masculinity and is like kind of something that really isn't talked about like when it's concerning like the feminist movements, or even like talking about the patriarchy. This is kind of like she talks about in the book also how like this is kind of something that a lot of people disagree on and stuff like that. But yeah, like I said, the patriarchy has extremely like consequential has extreme consequences on not just women but also men and boys as well. And this is something, like I was saying earlier, I was trying to word it in a different way and it just wasn't coming out how it was supposed to. This is something that like is not talked about enough, and is like should be included in feminist movements as well. And that's essentially her whole idea for the book. It's a really, really good book, and I think she describes like the issues that like men and boys go through because of the patriarchy very well, even though she herself is not a man. She obviously understands the patriarchy and all of the notions very, very well. I think it's a really, really good book, and honestly it kind of made me change the way I think. I feel like a big part of like I'm not going to say that. I think that's wrong. I'm not going to say it. I think it's a really, really good book. I kind of had to cut it short a little bit just because we're out of time. I spent too much time talking in the beginning of the show. But really, really good book. Highly recommend checking out Bell Hooks if you'd like. Super, super awesome. The Will to Change Men, Masculinity, and Love is the book that we were talking about and reviewing. Highly would recommend checking that out if you like, if you're into like feminist literature thought, or just need something to read. It's only 188 pages, very, very short. So shout out. I'm gonna end the show with a short clip of Bell Hooks essentially talking about the interlocking systems of domination, which kind of relate to this book and some of her other books as well. So stay tuned for that if you'd like. This was Book It, and I'll be back in January. Who knows? Bye.
Phrase in my work, white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, because I wanted to have some language that would actually remind us continually of the interlocking systems of domination that define our reality, and not to just have one thing be like, you know, gender is the important issue, race is the important issue. But for me, the use of that particular jargonistic phrase was a sort of shortcut way of saying all of these things actually are functioning simultaneously at all times in our lives. And that if I really want to understand what's happening to me right now at this moment in my life as a Black female of a certain age group, I won't be able to understand it if I'm only looking through the lens of race. I won't be able to understand it if I'm only looking through the lens of gender. I won't be able to understand it if I'm only looking at how white people see me. I mean, an important breakthrough I felt in my work and that of others was the call to use the term white supremacy over racism, because racism in and of itself did not really allow for a discourse of colonization and decolonization, the recognition of the internalized racism within people of color. And it was always, in a sense, keeping things at the level at which whiteness and white people remained at the center of the discussion. In my classroom, I might say to students, you know, that when we use the term white supremacy, it doesn't just evoke white people. It evokes a political world that we can all frame ourselves in relationship to. And I think that I was able to do that because I grew up, again, in racial apartheid, where there was a color caste system. So that obviously I knew that through my own experiential reality, you know, that it wasn't just what white people do to Black people that was wounding and damaging to our lives. I knew that when we went over to my grandmother's house, who looked white, who lived in a white neighborhood, and she called my sister Blackie because she was dark and her hair was nappy, and my sister would sit in the corner and cry or not want to go over there, I knew that there is some system here that is hurting this little girl, that is not directly the direct hit from the white person. And white supremacy was that term that allowed one to acknowledge our collusion with the forces of racism and imperialism. And so for me, those words were very much about the constant reminder, one, of institutional constructs, that we're not talking about personal constructs in the sense of how do you feel about me as a woman or how do you feel about me as a Black person, but they really seem to me to evoke a larger apparatus. And I don't know why those terms have become so mocked by people, because in fact, far from simplifying the issues, I think they actually, when you merge them together, really complicate the questions of freedom and justice globally, because it means then that we have to look at what Black people are doing to each other in Rwanda. We have to, and we can't just say racism, what have you. We have to problematize nationalism beyond race in all kinds of ways that I think there's a tremendous reluctance, particularly in the United States, to have a more complex accounting of identity.
Look out now, this is the Diz, Dizzy Gillespie that is, and let me give you some information. If you want to hear some good sounds, the sounds that's round, keep your radio tuned to KDBS in Davis, 90.3 on your FM dial. Look out! Ow! This is the Diz signing off.
Ooh. Welcome to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. When you hear the soulful tunes of John Scofield in the background, you know that the theme song of this particular public affairs program has begun, and that you can look forward to an hour of interviews, scintillating conversation, and sometimes recorded poetry. We run the gambit, if indeed there is a gambit between poetry and technology, and perhaps I've invented that gambit right here, we run the gambit between these two unlikely paired concepts, poetry and technology. For the last 24 years, I've featured interviews with poets and pundits, prognosticators, professors of religious studies. A great number of categories are represented here, all of them with projects to share with you, poems to read out loud, and talk about creativity, discovery, and principle. On this week's show, for instance, we're going to hear first from Julia Levine. Julia B. Levine is the outgoing poet laureate of the city of Davis, and her poetry has won a great number of awards. I could take up an entire introduction just naming her many books and her many awards. Sometimes 2, 3, 4 awards to a book. We won't be talking about any of that, though. We'll be talking instead about a special event, a poetic event, that she has in store for all of us tomorrow evening at the John Natsoulis Gallery, where middle school students from the city of Davis will share the work that they have composed with the tutelage, with the guidance, with the inspiration provided by Julia B. Levine. They'll be talking about eco-poetic concerns, concerns perhaps that weigh more heavily on the hearts of the 12, 13, and 14-year-olds who will be sharing these poems tomorrow night than even weigh on your hearts or my heart. Why? Because they're going to be around longer than we will be. We'll hear from Julia B. Levine. She's in a car heading to Davis right now. So it'll be a live and noisy interview, a brief one, with the most recent poet laureate of the city of Davis. Then we'll be joined around 5:30 by Dyson Smith. Dyson Smith is a Chicago-born poet who is studying statistics at the University of California, Davis. He's a third-year senior. What does that mean? That means that there is no moss growing on this rolling stone. He's also the producer of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. He's a submissions reader for Open Ceilings and a member